Hi, everybody. It's me, the Fetch, host of Inside the Eye Live. Before the Sunday mainstream media political pundit talk shows, there is Inside the Eye Live, where we break down some of the weekly mainstream media talking points before the talking points even get aired. Add in some entertaining stories, weather, cats, intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, the Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Welcome to Sacred Matrix, a divine paradigm of love and universal consciousness, with your host, Janet Kira Lesson and Dr. Sasha Lesson.
Together, we transform the world.
And now, here are your hosts, Janet Kira and Dr. Sasha Lesson.
Give you a little background on Dr. Farrell. Dr. P. Farrell was born in Sioux Falls, South Dakota in 1957. He has a BA in Biblical Studies and Philosophy, an MA in Historical and Theological Studies, and a PhD in Patristics. And note that is not physics, as it says on his bio, one of his publishers keeps insisting on saying that in spite of his best efforts to get them to change that. So I looked up what patristics is, and it's the study of the early Christian writers, what you call church fathers, and it goes from a period generally considered to run from the date at the end of the New Testament times or end of the apostolic age, which is AD 100, to either AD 451, which is the date of the Council of Chalcedon, or to the 8th century Second Council of Nicaea. So after, he likes to pursue, oh, here it is. He has a doctorate in statistics from the University of Oxford and pursues research in physics, alternative history, and science and strange stuff. After a lifelong interest in alternative history, science, and fascination for ancient texts, Joseph started writing in 2001 on these subjects. And he also studied pipe organs from the age of 6 until beginning college, and composes classical music for friends and family, and he also plays the harpsichord. I've been over for dinner sometime here tonight. And let me just scroll down. He is the author of all of these wonderful books, The Deeds of Death Star. There's 3 books in that trilogy, The Light of the Black Sun, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, The Cosmic War, Secrets of the Unified Field, The Philosopher's Stone, The Nazi International, Babylon's Banksters, Lars von der Reich, Bobby James and the Conspiracy to Kill Kennedy, Genes, Giants, Monsters and Men, Return of the Gods, Saucers, Swastikas and Psyops, and Yahweh, the Two-Faced God, oh, and Transhumanism, and so on and so forth. What an incredible person. Dr. Lesson, would you like to say something before we bring on Joseph?
Yes, I'm really excited about this. I've been very fascinated since the Kennedy's Defense Intelligence Agency has released, after 25 years, the information about how there was a German colony under Antarctica, and the Germans, maybe even led by the real Hitler, defeated Kurt Byrd and sunk the Pine Island and killed 60-some Marines, and basically we were, they had the flying bells and we didn't. And if it hadn't been for the Evens, according to my friend Len Kasdan, they would have taken the U.S., but we got our bells too. And so I know that you know a lot more about all this stuff than me, and I really eager to hear your program, Joseph.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
We're so excited to have you here. So is there anything that I missed in your bio that you'd like to tell our listeners about yourself before we begin the show?
No, that you pretty well covered it.
Yeah, I was looking for the bio online, and I came across all that, and it's like, wow, what an interesting person. Fascinating that I've been listening to your past interviews on YouTube. But I think what we said in our emails before we start the show, that you wanted to start with the pyramid series of your books, perhaps the Cosmic War. So you probably have a pretty new audience here that would like to know about this subject, the Giza Death Star and all that. Could you give them a little bit of your theory of what was going on with the pyramids?
Well, my theory is pretty well summarized by the title of that series of books. My theory is that the Great Pyramid, if you look at both the engineering and if you look at some of the ancient texts that I think refer to the structure, that the conclusion I came to was that this thing was some sort of weapon, a very sophisticated one. And I outlined my reasons for thinking that in those three books. I do think that it was I think the structure as we see it now at Giza is basically the shell of a machine. It's only partly a machine. I took the research wonderful book by Christopher Dunn, Giza Power Plant, is kind of my point of departure. I don't know how else to summarize it other than that.
Okay, so you're thinking that the Giza Pyramid is a weapon system. Some people are speculating that it's some kind of energy grid they're finding to resolve with the planet. Zechariah Sitchin has a theory of what it was. It was partially for navigation. Dr. Lesson, would you like to say something about what you think, and then we can start a dialogue?
Well, it's multifunctional. You could cite what constellation was arising in front of the stone lion. You could be sending a microwave up. It had lots of functions.
Well, I do think that it is the product of a highly unified physics. I think you can build a structure like that and basically, so to speak, with the turn of a dial, convert the function. I am not a subscriber to Sitchin's idea that it's a kind of a beacon for spaceports and all of that. I tend to have a lot of problems with Sitchin's macro scenario. That said, if you look at his book, The Wars of Gods and Men, he does in that book strongly suggest that the Great Pyramid was a weapon, or at least used as a weapon. I went one further in my book, The Cosmic War. I looked at various texts in that book and made kind of a case, a complex case, that if you look at the text carefully, what they strongly suggest is that there was some sort of pyramid weapon system in ancient times. And interestingly enough, Zechariah Sitchin concludes on the basis of his analysis of texts in his Wars of Gods and Men that the Great Pyramid had structural components inside of the building that were removed at the end of the war. And when I read Chris Dunn's Giza Power Plant, he comes to very much the same conclusion, but by a very different route. He also concluded that there were things present in the structure that it's, for whatever reason, he doesn't offer much of a reason, but that for whatever reason were removed. So I kind of take off from those two men in compiling my hypothesis in those three books.
Okay. Sasha,
What happens is that in the Second Pyramid War, Inanna is chasing Marduk through the pyramid, and Anu communicates with her, saying, listen, you better not catch him. He's got all kinds of weapons, and he'll kill you. And then when Ninurta actually comes in and breaks everything that he can't use, and he takes the Gug stone and lots of other stuff, and especially the capacitating crystals that are above where the hydrochloric acid and hydrated zinc cause the hydrogen explosion. And he takes what he can, he leaves, he breaks what he doesn't take. That's what Sitchin says about the Second Pyramid War. Also, he also talks about the shield around it. When Nergal joined Horon and Marduk and Enki, he strengthened the shield around the pyramid, whatever that means.
Well, I examined the Ethic of Ninurta. In fact, I reproduced the whole thing in my book, The Cosmic War, because I want people to read this thing, because academics call it an epic. And when you read it, it's rather like reading the index to the Sears catalog. It's one of the most boring pieces of literature that you could ever read, because all it is an inventory of stones, quite literally, crystals probably of some sort, that were removed from the mountain, which I make the case that, you know, when you're dealing with the term acro, you're dealing with a term that has multi-level meanings. But it was removed, these things were removed from the pyramid, and there's actually four classes of things that are inventoried. There are things that are, as Sitchin indicates, there are things that are carted off and used in other ways for other things. There are things that are destroyed. There are things, a very small class of things that are apparently very important that cannot be destroyed, and so they're hidden, which I think is the most interesting category. But yeah, this text is basically a big inventory, and that's about all there is to it.
That's fascinating.
What I'm wondering is, many times when they allude to crystals, it seems that they could very well be saying what we would call computers. We have crystals inside our computers, little teeny carved pieces of silicone, and so that I'm not sure crystals means exactly what we hippies think of as crystals. It may have meant something else.
Well, I do make an interesting case in The Cosmic War that if you look at these items carefully, they appear to be some sort of data storage device, but they're not data storage devices in the typical sense. The way I interpret them is that they are the templates for what a physicist would call a phase conjugate mirror. A phase conjugate mirror, these things began to be developed during President Reagan, during the Star Wars program. What they are a mirror that take a picture of the distortion in the atmosphere, and then you shine a laser beam actually through the picture of the distortion. What this does is it conjugates the waves of the laser so that they arrive at the target coherent without atmospheric distortion effects. It's a bit more tricky than that, but that's it kind of in a nutshell. But the crystals that you look at in the text, they really aren't referred to as crystals. They're simply referred to as stones, but my guess is that they were probably some sort of crystal. I think that they were probably, and again, I'm compacting a lot of information here. We don't have time to, you know, go into all of it, but it's in the book, The Cosmic War. But basically, I think that they were the data, so to speak, of the phase conjugate signatures of all the important planetary systems that this society needed in order to make a weapon like that work. It's a rather complex case. I know it sounds kind of ridiculous when you hear it put so shortly and curtly, but they were essentially the targeting information. If we think of the Great Pyramid, for example, as an ICBM for a moment, to draw an analogy, you basically have a worthless scrap of hardware without the targeting information in the ICBM. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what I think these things were.
Well, let me ask a question to try to get some foundation here. So we're indicating there's a cosmic war. So Who are the factions of the war? Who built the pyramids? And who was the faction that was defending the pyramids? Were they defending the entire Earth or just that region of the Earth? And who were they defending it against? Do you have any ideas?
Well, I go into that a great deal in the cosmic war. The way I look at that particular war, as it's outlined in some of those texts that I examine in that book, is I draw an analogy to World War I. Basically, what you have is a kind of a civil war in the pantheon of gods, much like Sitchin portrays it in Wars of Gods and Men. I push the dating back much further back into history. I view it as kind of a civil war amongst all of these interrelated gods. And I like the analogy of World War I because, of course, you had Kaiser Wilhelm being the grandson of Queen Victoria and the cousin to Tsar Nicholas II and related by other family connections to the House of Savoy in Italy and to the Habsburgs in Austria. So you look at World War I in a certain way, and it's a big family fight. And that's what you have, I think, with the Cosmic War. Now, as to who built it, what I think you're dealing with, quite bluntly, is you are dealing with what I like to call genetic cousins. In other words, I think that humanity, at least as far as the ancient texts portray it, humanity, the genus Homo, has several species within it. I think we're looking kind of at genetic cousins that would probably look a great deal like us, perhaps walk like us and so on. I do think that you're looking essentially at a human, and by human, I mean the genus rather than the species. In other words, we're the species Homo sapiens sapiens. So I think you're looking at essentially a human civilization that went to war with itself and tore itself apart.
Okay. Do you think that was Anunnaki?
Well, I don't get into the whole question of Anunnaki all that much in depth in the book. However, that said, like I just said, if you look at those texts, the Bible, Genesis chapter 6, if you look at the Mesopotamian texts that refer to the Anunnaki and so on, they all indicate that humanity was, so to speak, genetically engineered into existence. And you had male donors of the so-called gods, and you had female donors from whatever sort of prototypical human hominid that they found on Earth that they used to more or less genetically engineer mankind into existence. Well, if you look at what this is suggesting, is, again, that we have some sort of cousins. In other words, that the genus Homo is not necessarily restricted to planet Earth. There may be a branch of the family out there somewhere, and they came here, and engineered us into existence, quite literally. Excuse me.
Sosh, would you like to say something on it?
Yeah, I'm still there. This may well be the ancestor of the other hominoid that's still around, Bigfoot.
Right. There's all sorts of ways to approach this, but my take is if there are such beings, they're more likely to be a family cousin to us rather than a species far removed from us, which would be much more difficult to genetically engineer, some sort of blending of the two. So that's always kind of the way I've looked at those texts.
So you basically kind of follow the story that Sitchin outlined in his book. But it was also Kramer. He outlines it as well, which goes back and forth. Sitchin, Kramer,
well,
did the research in the 50s.
Again, I'm not trying to follow Sitchin or Kramer or anybody else. Like I said, I have big problems with Sitchin's macro scenario. For one thing, you know, he's got this idea that we have the planet Nibiru that is more or less orbiting the sun off the plane of the ecliptic by several degrees, careening through the solar. Careening through the solar system every 3,160 years. And I have a huge problem with that. The problem being the physics. If that were the case, it would be like fishing bobbers on a pond. You know, if you're going to periodically drop a big rock into the pond, they're going to keep bobbing more or less in a certain type of frequency. We don't see this. We're lacking the physics signature. The other problem I have is I'm not a catastrophist. I just don't subscribe to the idea of planetary collisions being responsible for the missing planet in the asteroid belt. The other problem I have with his scenario is he's got all of this, so to speak, interplanetary commerce taking place with rocket ships and wars fought with nuclear weapons. And, you know, a rocket ship is pretty much a Pony Express way to try and have any sort of interplanetary civilization going on in the solar system. I'm not a subscriber to his macro scenario. I think he's very helpful in some of the details he provides, but my scenario is very, very different from his. But I think the main point here is that when I did Cosmic War, I looked at a very broad variety of texts to come to very different conclusions than he did, particularly regarding the kind of weaponry that I think was used in the war.
All right. So you would say that there's two factions in the war, in this war, and they're both of the same humanoid. They're probably Anunnaki. I have the Sitchin understanding because I studied the Sitchin. Mm-hmm. I understand that Sitchin was doing the best he could. He started writing in the 1970s. But always, whenever we're looking at it, it's historical information or even futuristic information, it always comes to the filters of who we are in the now. When we're doing the research, right? We can't help it. We always put our human element into it in our interpretations. That's what Roddenberry said. He said, I can only do a 1960s version of what life is going to be like in 2350, right? He said, I can't possibly do 2350. I think it's always going to have the overlay of who we are in the 60s talking about the future. So with that in mind, and I think you're talking about that with Whitley Strieber, I have to understand what I'm saying, is that probably some of the pictures were, you know, of something that might be a rocket ship. But now, I mean, we don't even have the next generation. What is it? What are we going to get a space in? We still have primitive technology. We have, you know, the shuttle. But there's something else coming. We know there's something else coming. It's just one step beyond our what we're imagining, what we're known. We know that the governments are hiding. So it's probably there already. Okay.
What I think we have is two sets of hypothetical constructs to account for the data.
Yes.
Of how the asteroid belt and the Earth have their current vision, and what we need to do is to set up what kind of data would show that we're which is more likely and which would disprove each one. And so some of the things that are impressive about what the Sumerians say, whatever their hypothesis, however they got their hypotheses, you know, anthropomorphizing planets and whatever, is they say that you're going to find the same stuff in the asteroid belts as Earth. And, you know, they make a bunch of things like that are predictions based on what they told the Sumerians were their observations in space, which now we can test some of those. And it seems that they had a pretty good batting average, even if they explained it in ways that, that don't work for us. And so then the question is your system more efficient, parsimonious, accounting for more of the data more easily? That's how I look at it.
Right.
So what is your theory on how we got the asteroid belt?
Well, I think it was, I think there was a planet that was quite literally blown up during that war. And I get into this a great deal in the Cosmic War, and I follow the former Naval Observatory astronomer, Dr. Tom Van Flandern, wrote a wonderful book called Dark Matter, New Comets and Missing Planets. Pardon me. And he basically revived the late 18th century, early 19th century idea of the astronomers that the asteroid belt was the remains of a planet that had blown up. Pardon me. And the interesting thing is, in Dr. Van Flandern's book, he discusses a variety of models by which a planet would blow up. And he proposes a variety of natural explanations, a fission reaction in the core of the planet that got out of control and blew it up. He discusses a antimatter that was self-contained in the core of the planet, and then for some reason the containment collapsed and blew up. But the problem is, of course, with all of these models, you're dealing with reactions that really don't make much sense. And you can tell, as he's proposing these models, that he's not entirely comfortable with them. And at one point in his book, he actually comes right down and says, and the final thing that we have to consider is that it may have been by some sort of technology. And he proposes, number one, that it may have been a technology that got out of control and blew it up. Or he also says it may have been, and these are his words, a deliberate act. And of course, when you say deliberate act, you're talking about war. And this is what the ancient texts indicate. So that's kind of the way I started out in the Cosmic War, and why I wrote that book, is because I think that the catastrophist models that we have, they leave things wanting. They are, in my opinion, playing kind of fast and loose with some of the ancient texts. They're having to allegorize the texts. And I think Van Flandern has it absolutely correct. I think the natural models for blowing up a planet really aren't there. And then if that's the case, we have to take seriously the idea that there may have been a technology sophisticated enough, and therefore physics sophisticated enough to do that. And that's where I come down in the book, that it was blown up as part of an act of war.
When did this happen?
That's a good question. In that book, I do not attempt, and I want people to please understand this, the chronological difficulties of sorting all of this out, of taking all of these disparate data sets, astronomical time, the geology of the planet Earth, and so on, and then the texts themselves. You're dealing basically with three different data sets, and there's really no easy way to make all of them mesh together. So I paint in very, very broad strokes in that book. Now, Van Flandern, when he looks at the exploded planet hypothesis, basically what he does, or what he did, was he took computer programs of all of the orbits of comets, ran them backwards to see if they originated within the asteroid belt at a certain point in time. And lo and behold, they did. But there were two points of time that seemed to account for the origin of comets as being the debris of a planetary explosion. And one date is approximately 65 million years ago. The other date is approximately 3.2 million years ago. And I took the latter date, even though the KT boundary layer geological evidence on planet Earth would suggest more strongly the 65 million year date, and that's the date that he prefers. I took the 3.2 million years date because it's much easier, in my opinion, to deal with the text with a much more recent date. We'd have to add to that data set the complications of the dating of some of the alleged artifacts on Mars, which if you look at the work of Dr. Mark Carlotto, he comes up with dates between 125,000 years ago and 650,000 years ago for whatever catastrophe hit Mars. So in other words, what I'm trying to show people here is you're dealing with very, very disparate data sets. But yeah, I think if we're looking at that kind of planetary catastrophe, we're looking at something in more recent history in terms of astronomical and geological time than 65 million years ago.
Okay. You have anything to say on that, Dr. Wilson?
No, I'm just, I'm wondering, you know, when the World Trade Center came down, they said, you've got to check for this this residue of the charges. And so I'm wondering if indeed it was hit by some kind of weapon, whether there would be traces. I mean, that would be the hypothesis that I would then go with, that would show that it was a weapon, or there would be some kind of evidences of what it was, some
right.
residue.
Right. Well,
yeah, well,
go ahead.
Let me add something to go back to. The Sumerians have the Anunnaki coming here 46,000 years ago. So it's 3.2 million or 65 million years ago, and it was a war that caused it, then it must be more of a galactic war, another civilization, which is what basically, like Stuart Swerdlow and other people that are you know, whistleblowers have said, that there was a kind of like a universal galactic war going on with people like the Lyrians and other humanoid-type species. So it kind of takes it into another level. At least from, you know, the information that I know. But back to you.
Well, the idea of a weapon here is crucial, because the only way, in my opinion, that you have a physics sufficient enough to blow up a planet would be a physics that would be capable of manipulating the fabric of space-time and weaponizing that manipulation. In other words, we're talking about something that quite literally would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. And if you're going to have that kind of weapon, then you have the signatures you're going to look for would be, you're going to have a coupled harmonic oscillator, is what the physicists would call it, that would couple to all of the phenomena, the significant dimensional geometrical phenomena of local celestial space. And when you look at the Great Pyramid, this is in fact what you find. You find dimensional analogs within the structure of local celestial space. You have the distance from the Earth to the Sun. You've got the neutral point of gravity between the Earth and the Moon, and so on and so forth. And, you know, why do you have all of these things present in a structure just to bury a pharaoh? So, you know, my conclusion is you don't have those things in a structure just to bury a pharaoh, but you would have them in a structure if you were attempting to use that structure to couple to all of the local energies implied in the geometry of local celestial space. And that's what you have. So I think that they're dealing with a very, very sophisticated physics back then, whoever built the thing. And when you look at the Sumerian kings list, you look at the Egyptian kings list and so on, you're dealing with a time frame. And here again, we're at that third data set. The texts are indicating, if you take them literally and at their word, they're indicating the beginning of whatever sort of prehistory civilization that existed at approximately 240 to 260,000 years ago. And I think that's rather interesting, because recently geneticists are pushing the date of the origins of modern man back into that sort of time period. So we're dealing with a lot of different things. I don't think that anybody that claims that they've sorted out all the chronological difficulties, I honestly don't think that we're in a position yet that we can do that. We have to paint in very broad strokes. So it may be the texts might be off by orders of magnitude in their dating. It may be that there's some geological evidence on other planets that we have not yet factored into this. There could be all sorts of things. So I leave the chronology of all this kind of open-ended.
And that's very wise.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Sasha. Do you have anything to say about Sasha's anthropologist in LA? When did when did man come about approximately? Like
Humans. Cremo has found skeletons at almost every level, at the 650,000 year level, at the 65 million a year ago level, and so forth. And the dates, I totally know what you're saying. It's all jumped around. The Anunnaki were certainly one of the first visitors here, and the hominoids before them were placed suddenly without predecessors, and Lloyd Pye's work shows that there's been a series of seedings, and basically nothing has evolved from one genus to another genus. Most of the species that were here were introduced during the Cambrian. Macroevolution seems to be false on this planet anyway. Microevolution is true. There's been sudden evolution from seeding is what it looks like to me.
Yeah, it looks that way to me too. I get into that aspect of things a little bit more in a book called Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, looking at some of the genetic work that's been done, Brian Sykes in Oxford, for example, some other people, and they're pushing the origins of modern man back now to about 150 to 200,000 years ago, which puts us in the rough time frame of some of those ancient kings lists. So yeah, something was going on. Humanity, I've personally never been a subscriber to macroevolutionary theory, at least as far as mankind is concerned, because like you say, it just seems to have too many problems when you really start to look at the details and you add Cremo and Thompson's work, where you've got a whole host of very strange, clearly machined archaeological artifacts dating, in some cases, to millions, if not billions, of years ago. And you're dealing with a huge, huge problem. So all of these things, you know, when you factor in all of these things, Dr. Lesson, you're really dealing with a data set that, as far as I'm concerned, no researcher should claim to close yet, because we're still on the beginning part of this research. We're nowhere close to coming up with a coherent, consistent picture in a detailed fashion yet.
Yeah, and what we have is, you know, we happen to have gotten the records of one group of grandiose people who are tooting their own horns and disagreeing with each other, and we don't have the rest of the story. There's a lot
right.
for us to learn.
Right.
In the wall at Puma Puka, where there seems to be representations of different kinds of beings that passed through, there's some bas reliefs that look like cone heads. There's some that look like grays. There's a whole range of different visitors, I think, to this planet.
That could possibly be, you know, I really don't get in any of my books into much speculation about who's been visiting or why or what or, you know, where they're coming from. I'm primarily a researcher. I stick as close as I can to the texts, to the data, but I'm not afraid to speculate. You know, I'm certainly not afraid to speculate, but what's really important for people to take away from this is when you're talking about trying to reconstruct these things, you've basically got three different data sets that you have to deal with. You've got geological and archaeological evidence. You've got extraterrestrial archaeological and geological evidence. You've got astronomical events like exploding planets. And then finally, you've got all these texts on this planet that indicate that something went on, that there was a big war that was fought, that it was quite destructive. So yeah, you have to leave the chronological questions open, I think.
So we're going back to the Giza Death Star and the wars that were going on there. And so we're not sure who is, that war seems to be the battle between the factions. We have the Enlilites and the Anchilites, if you use the Sitchin cosmology. And
right.
The third faction brought in Mars, and then the Sitchin Sumerian story, which by Kramer as well, they talk about the Igigi came down for Marduk's wedding, and they were the 200-300, and it's the story of the rape of the Sabine women, but they wanted women for their wives, and Anu was forbidding it, and they were all forbidding it, and they just came down at the wedding, and they took them, and then that turned into one of the wars. Sasha studied all the third.
That was at Baalbek, honey. That was in Lebanon, the landing platform in Lebanon.
Right.
The wedding of Sarpanid and Marduk. The rape of the Sabine women is what it came down to when the
right.
Roman times. But this wasn't in the pyramid. I think what the point about using the pyramid, and it certainly is not inconsistent with having it as a major a weapon targeting system, is that it was visible on a certain geographical line to the landing field in Sinai. And it certainly could be both a landmark and a weapon.
Well, I want to bring Mars into this. So, Dr. Farrell, could you tell us what your theory is about how Mars comes into play in the wars, or is it in this story?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I am one of those that subscribes to the idea that there appear to be structures on Mars that are of artificial origin, and I'm not even really referencing the famous face on Mars or the Cydonia complex. There's been a lot of much more recent releases from NASA of structures that are very, very clear. NASA hasn't, interestingly enough, NASA hasn't commented very much about these things. I've blogged about them on my website, but very clearly there was something up there. There was somebody up there with intelligence building things a long time ago. Now, the interesting thing about Mars is if you look at Mars, one whole hemisphere of Mars looks as if it had been suddenly concussed by massive amounts of flooding. And this would fit very, very well with Dr. Van Flanders' exploding planet hypothesis. Pardon me. He thinks that Mars was at one time a satellite of a much larger solid water-bearing planet that now occupies the asteroid belt. When that planet blew up, of course, the shockwave would have hit Mars and basically stripped whatever atmosphere it had off of it. It would have knocked its magnetosphere all awry, which is what we see. And we do see that hemispheric evidence of flooding on Mars. So he thinks that Mars was released after that planet exploded as a satellite of that planet and assumed its current rather eccentric orbit because of all of this. And that's basically my scenario as well. I think Mars was caught up in this war, that it was a victim of that exploding planet. And interestingly enough, you know, that would explain all of the legends that we have here on Earth of the planetary-wide flood. The problem is there's more evidence of a planetary-wide flood on Mars than there is on Earth. So in other words, these legends have come to us handed down from, in my opinion, from high antiquity, by that branch of humanity that remains here on Earth. And that assumes, of course, that that we have or had at one point possibly a connection on Mars as well.
The Sumerian story, and I think it was at the time of the flood, said that the when that passing of Nibiru, or it could have been, you know, yeah, something, it is in Lagrange points in Nibiru, probably Nibiru, but it was so catastrophic that it also caused a lot of havoc on Mars. I think that's when the atmosphere got ripped off. Sasha, Dr. Lesson, you have more of the details on that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, first of all, when as far as the Anunnaki tales that Sitchin reports, is that Enki wasn't going to use nukes to blast through the Earth from the Nibiru as Alalu had. Instead, he used diverted all the water from his ship and blew the asteroids out of the way, and the ship started overheating. And there's definitely the same rocket ship. And they landed on Mars next to a lake. They found the atmosphere was thin. They replenished their water. And then later on, when Anu banished Alalu to die on Mars and dropped Anzu off with them, he said to Anzu, if you survive, we'll start a base up here. So Anu sent his daughter, the Dr. Nimma, back, and she gave Anzu, who had survived, 20 men to start Mars base, and they made a statue at Cydonia with a Balalu's face showing underneath his eagle's hat. And then Anzu came in, and he took over. He was the grandson of Balalu, and he got the Emmys, the computer programs, and basically had control of everything. And then finally, Minerda challenged him, and because Enki told him how the ships were made, he was able to beat him. And this is a description of an aerial battle with what things that we would recognize as fighter planes. And they may have other ways of traveling, but these are definitely described in Sitchin's rendition of this Sumerian stuff as airplanes and rocket ships. And as far as Earth, as Mars goes, Janet's quite right about Mars pace being, after Anzu was executed by Ninurta, Marduk got the job of running Mars base, but then the same, it passed through ruined Mars base. This was actually before the flood, even. It had already ruined Mars base. And so Marduk didn't have a base, and that's why he and the GG came down and basically settled on Earth. The other thing is, in modern times, Anja Bashago has been to Mars many times and has reported lots of artifacts there, and as well as creatures and living beings.
Right, and there's a story that whistleblowers are saying there's a current Mars base that is, so we don't know about that part, but that's coming into play with the modern era. So, okay, back to you, Joseph. Thank you. So, we covered, are we done with Mars? What else do we want to say about Mars?
That's up to you.
Okay.
I want to hear about what happened to the how the Nazis beat Byrd and how they took over our government with paperclip. And you know all about that. That's what I want to hear about.
Well,
please come in here. I can hardly hear you. Maybe if you come in here, we can just share a phone. You want to hang up that one and come in here because it's not working very well.
Okay.
So yeah, we're going from the ancient. And so how do we get from the ancients down through time to the Nazis ruling everything? Are they the Anunnaki? Are the Nazis the Anunnaki?
No.
Are they Germans? Who are Germans? Who's Jesus? I mean, it's like we're going from the ancients, like all this history in between. What's going on? Are these
human? The principal connection between all of this ancient lore and the Nazis, in my opinion, is their physics, the type of physics that they were investigating. Now, I want to make one thing very clear to people. I do not subscribe, for a whole host of very complex reasons, to the idea that the Nazis had a secret UFO flying saucer research base in Antarctica with all sorts of exotic weapons that they used to chase Admiral Byrd and his Operation High Jump military expedition out of that continent. I do not subscribe to that for the very simple reason that if you look at the story of what they were investigating prior to and during the war in detail, it would have required, as it did with the Nazi Bell, it would have required electrical power of an enormous amount, which certainly was not available to them in Antarctica. I point out in my books that the Nazis built an entire power plant, an electrical power plant, within mere hundreds of yards of the facilities where they were testing the Bell device. And that clued me in. That's one of the data points that I used to try and reconstruct a speculative case of what the Bell was and what they were trying to do, because that to me is the clue that they needed massive amounts of direct current electricity in order for them to test this device. And it is the only device. I'm not a subscriber to the Hanabu or the Vril stories of all of these field propulsion Nazi flying saucers during World War II. There's just no good provenance for those stories. There's no physics details that you can attempt to kind of reverse engineer the thought process of what they were doing. You do have that with the Bell. So in other words, they would have had to have built an electrical power plant in Antarctica, and then during the war, of course, keep it supplied to the point that they could produce electrical power. So I'm not a subscriber to that idea. I do think that said, just so that people know where I'm coming from here, the devil's in the details. This is why actually reading the books to find out what I've said and why I've said it is very important. I do think that Admiral Byrd encountered something in Antarctica. It may have been, as far as I know, it may have been German or Nazi, but if it was, it was most likely something that came to Antarctica from bases in southern Argentina, in Patagonia, Tierra del Fuego, and so on, and intercepted him there. I do think that the Germans prior to and during the war constructed some sort of perhaps weather station, perhaps a small U-boat base in Antarctica, but nothing like what all the myths and legends that you hear out there on the internet and so on, nothing of that scale. Whatever Admiral Byrd ran into, whatever it was certainly technologically sophisticated enough that he hightailed it out of there after a month or so. He was equipped for an expedition of several months. He hightailed it out of there. He gave an interesting interview to El Mercurio, a newspaper in Santiago de Chile, and it's that interview that you get him saying that the United States had to prepare against enemy fighters that could fly from pole to pole with tremendous speed. Now he doesn't identify this enemy. You know, who's the enemy? Is it somebody extraterrestrial? Well, we don't know. Is it somebody given that time frame? Is he talking about the Soviet communists? Is he talking about Nazis? We simply don't know. But I think there's enough evidence to suggest that the Nazis were doing something of a high caliber research nature, but they weren't doing it in Antarctica. They were doing it in Argentina. So if it was
let me,
Nazis,
let me ask you a question. Let me ask
sure.
you a question. Do you think, first of all, is the Bell the same as the Foo Fighters? You know, those
No.
And then did the Nazis get their technology from extraterrestrials?
No.
Stories of that, or did they recover it from the ancient information they were trying to find?
No.
How did they come by their technology?
Okay, that's the question to ask. I am not a subscriber to the Nazis having reverse engineered a crashed and recovered UFO. Again, if you read my books, you'll discover that what I attempt to do is reverse engineer from the data set of the Bell a possible physics rationale of what they may have been thinking when they built this device. And the other thing I attempt to do in my books, I've talked about this project in virtually every book that I have written on the subject of Nazis, because it is an extraordinarily complex story. The details are rich enough that you have to parse them very, very carefully. One of the things I do in a book called Secrets of the Unified Field is I attempt to show you, and this really begins in SS Brotherhood of the Bell as well, I attempt to show people that the thinking of the scientists, particularly in Germany, between the wars can be reconstructed without appeals to crashed flying saucers and those types of things. Oops.
Well, we'll have to stop at that and just hold for our break. We're with the Bell, and we'll be back in 5 minutes. Thank you very much. See you in a few. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Sacred Matrix on Revolution Radio at freedomsits.com with your host, Janet Kierlesson, and Dr. Sasha Lesson. And before we get back to our fascinating show with Dr. Joseph P. Serrell, I want to remind our listeners that Revolution Radio is listener-supported, and we rely on your donations to operate. So please do take a few minutes now and go over to the donation button on the website and donate what you can. $1, $5, $10, $15, $20, whatever you can donate will be greatly appreciated. We do need your funds to keep us growing. And thank you very much for your donation. And I have a question for Dr. Farrell, and then Sasha will do the next one. But what I wondered is, if we have this whole story back in the Vedas and everything about these ancients and their wars, and the Sumerian stuff called the Anunnaki, where did they go to? Did they leave, or are they the royals that are here in control of the planet today, or who is in control? So what do you think about all that?
Well, my suspicion is that at the conclusion of that cosmic war, and this has been basically the model that I've been operating with in the sequels to that book, is first of all that war was so destructive that basically they tore their own infrastructure apart, and they saw it coming as they were doing it. So what they did effectively was they created a complex of mythologies, first of all, that would encode and preserve as much of their scientific knowledge as they could. This is basically kind of the thesis that you find in Hamlet's Mill with De Santayana and Hertha von Dechent, and the thesis that they present. I think this is the first thing they did. The second thing they did was they constituted various elites, I think, on this planet to preserve and hand down that knowledge, and also to begin the process, and this is quite important, to begin the process of rebuilding, of preserving as much of humanity as they could. One of the key activities, in my opinion, that they would have done to kickstart civilization back up would have been to create the mechanisms necessary for commerce. Now, to do that, to conduct commerce, you have to have, without fail, you have to have a system of reliable weights and measures that can be reproduced anywhere on the globe. And of course, in order to have a reliable system of weights and measures, you have to have geodetically based and astronomically based measures. So I think in part, this activity accounts for some of the megalithic building projects that you see spread all over the planet, from Stonehenge and places like that in Great Britain and all over the planet. So I think you're dealing with surviving elites. Now, do they constitute themselves as some of the surviving royal bloodlines and so on? That I don't know. I do present the case in a couple of my books, Babylon's Banksters being one of them, Financial Vipers of Venice being another, that insofar as you can trace the bloodlines of noble houses and royal houses in Europe back, you can only do so in the written records to about the 9th to the 10th centuries in the Middle Ages. At that point, you're relying on conjecture. So nobody can make an ironclad case that the modern nobility or royalty or what have you, nobody can make an ironclad case that they are descendant from some of those ancient elites from Mesopotamia or Egypt. However, there is a lot of highly suggestive data once you look at it and see what it is. But again, there's nothing that connects it directly to this or that family. So it's largely a speculative case, Janet, that I argue in Gene Strand's and the two banking books. I have no difficulty.
Well, I have a question.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, you're familiar with Sir Lawrence Gardner. He does give a genealogy going
yes.
all the way back.
Yes, he does.
Yeah,
but again, you have to understand, he is arguing a speculative case. I have no problem with people that do that. But to make the case ironclad, you would have to make it a genetically based case. And this has not, at least to my knowledge, ever been done publicly. I have my suspicions that they might be looking for some of these markers privately or secretly. But
isn't the blue-eyed people of a genetic marker back to a common ancestor that suddenly emerged? I'm looking at the YouTubes 10,000 years ago, but it actually was the before that. Noah had the blue eyes.
Well, you do have ancient lore that talks about blonde-haired or red-haired and blue-eyed Caucasian-like sounding people teaching the arts of civilization. You've got Quetzalcoatl and Viracocha in South America and Mesoamerica, Kukulcan in Mesoamerica. You've got some indications in some texts that this was the way that Tahuta was described in Egypt and so on. But again, there's nothing compellingly conclusive about any of this. We have to understand that these are argued cases, that they're the only way to make a case like that is through very, very thorough documenting of genetic haplogroups, and to my knowledge, nothing like that has been made public yet. Like I say, it's my suspicion. I think that's what they're looking for secretly, but there's been nothing like that that has been done publicly.
Well, it's interesting. The way Sitchin translates the Sumerian stuff is that the first female that could bear when Mengishita found the X and XY chromosome. And she was put in the Damkina, the wife of Enki. And this child, the first female who had the mitochondrial DNA, I guess, from Damkina, was blonde and blue-eyed, whereas the first boy, the Adamu,
300,000 years ago in Sitchin's schema, had skin the dark red-brown color of the African clay. Anyway, I guess this is all, you know, just based not on a blood analysis, but one thing that I think is really clear to everybody is that the so-called elite isn't elite and isn't better than everybody, and then they're just as big of fools as the rest of us.
I would agree with that.
So then the big catastrophic event that I'm aware of is Sodom and Gomorrah, which was apparently a nuclear explosion. If you go over and you study the soil over there, it's the same as what happens after the nuclear explosions we have in our testing grounds. So, okay, so we're going from the ancient to the modern. And it's hard to prove anything. What is that proof? But we have some stories that kind of correlate with each other. We have Lawrence Gardner. I actually talked to a woman who had one of the libraries, and they were referencing, they were cataloging everything, and she said that there were like 7,000 references to Enki and stuff. So anyway, it seems to go through, and that's why the royals, I've heard, are so attached to their genealogy, because it proves their connection to the gods, and then that's why they deem themselves superior is their bloodline. That's why they're racist. They will only mate with their cousins and, you know, very close gene pool.
So how do they manipulate the banking system and keep us enslaved? I know you got the inside on that.
We'll start with the money. Money is the root of all evil. When did this evil stuff start? Go.
Well, again, that's another very, very complex story. I've got two books that deal with banking directly. One is called Babylon's Banksters, and then the sequel to that is called Financial Vipers of Venice. If you look back at the type of money that was in circulation in Mesopotamia in very, very ancient times, what you have is essentially what we would now call debt-free money. You had little clay tablets that were circulated as receipts against the surpluses in the state warehouse. And these tablets were issued by, let's say, the crown, to use a modern legal term. And usually they were issued with the tacit approval or actually directly from the various temples. So in other words, you always find money in these contexts in two relationships, one to the crown and one to the temple. And in addition to these little clay tablets, you also had circulating in Mesopotamia as bills of exchange, quite literally, or even in some cases you had loans that were circulated, monetized debt that were circulated privately between individuals, much like we would buy a mortgage today. A company will come in and buy a mortgage from another company. So all of this was circulating more or less as money. The problem begins when you begin to see the rise of international commerce. In other words, a clay tablet in Sumer or Ur or what have you is going to be good in those areas, but it's not going to be good for conducting trade, let's say, with Memphis in Egypt or with the Indus Valley in India. So at this juncture, a very interesting thing begins to happen. You see the rise of what one of the people that I reference in Babylon's Banksters calls the bullion brokering class, because bullion becomes more or less the de facto medium of exchange between different societies. And what this does is it's very interesting. It begins a cycle, because what do you do to get bullion? Well, you go out and you get slaves to mine the silver mines and to mine the gold mines. And in order to get slaves, what do you have to do? Well, you have to raise ever more and more armies to go and conquer people, to have the slaves, to mine the bullion, to pay the armies, to go conquer people, to mine, see what's going on. So in other words, you start getting locked into this ancient version of the military-industrial complex, One author that I consulted calls it the coinage military slavery complex. All right. Now, at that juncture, what begins to happen also is you have this bullion brokering class align itself with the temple because the temple is intimately connected with the issuance of money. And what do? Well, they do the old banker game. They begin to circulate counterfeit receipts. Let's say you're in Babylon and you're one of these bullion brokers. So what do? You start counterfeiting clay tablets and issuing them into circulation. And what you're doing is you're collapsing the currency. And at that juncture, what they start doing is they substitute bullion for these debt-free receipts. And they charge commissions, of course, in order to do this because they have to have the money to do what? To pay the military to go and conquer slaves, to man the mines, to mine the bullion. So on and on the spiral goes. Now, what's very interesting is that this accounts for, if you look at the rise of the big empires, they're all doing this. And what's very interesting is that by the time of the Roman Republic and then later, of course, Imperial Rome, you have an interesting thing going on vis-a-vis gold and silver. Because silver, if you look at the Orient predominantly, their predominant valuation is that silver is more valuable than gold. If you look at the West, if you look at the West, their predominant valuation is that gold is more valuable than silver. So in other words, what now begins to happen is this international bullion brokering class begins to manipulate the gold to silver ratio between the two regions of the world and the trade that's being conducted between them. So in other words, now you've got a very ensconced economic mercantilist class, if you will. And this class continues right on up into the rise of Venice as a banking power. And of course, Venice, if you study the history very carefully, Venice becomes the bullion market of Europe. And this is especially true during the High Renaissance. And what do? Well, they're caught time and again manipulating the gold to silver ratio in Western Europe by releasing gluts of gold and then hoarding gold and so on and so forth. They do this constantly. So you see the rise of a mercantilist oligarchical banking class in Venice that's deeply connected to bullion, that's deeply connected to trading bills of exchange as international currency. This is also going on in the Middle Ages. And then, of course, once Venice, I'm giving you a very high overview here, obviously. This is the Cliff Notes version. But with the discovery of the New World, what happens is very, very interesting. You have Genoese bankers involved with the funding of Ferdinand and Isabella. You've got Florence and the Medici's involved in the financing of them and Christopher Columbus. Well, what's really going on? You know, Christopher Columbus is Genoese. Genoa is the big rival of Venice. Venice is dutifully exporting its whole cosmology and philosophy to Elizabethan England. So what you really see going on is over time and viewed from the big picture and from a very long time scale, you have the banking oligarchies of the northern Italian city-states transplanting themselves and their base of operations to the Atlantic powers so that they can continue business as usual. I don't know how else to put it. That's it in a nutshell.
That's really useful. Thank you.
Oh yeah, you're quite welcome. You've got huge Florentine and Venetian connections in late medieval and early Renaissance England. And then, of course, the other thing you have to be aware of is that the Italian bankers called their family fortunes the family fundi, the foundation, in other words. So what you have is the beginning of this idea of of no private ownership of the wealth, but you retain control over it. In other words, you're looking at Venetian versions of the Rockefeller Foundation or the Carnegie Foundation or what have you. And it's very interesting that during the High Renaissance, Venice actually pays off all of its state debt, turns it into liquid capital. And in other words, what you're looking at are all the signs of a flight capital scheme, because what they're getting ready to do is move shop. They're quite literally no longer able to sustain their geopolitical position because of the discovery of the New World. So what do? They move all of this first to Amsterdam. And what's Amsterdam? Well, it's a city in a swamp, just like Venice. And then eventually, of course, they take all of this banking over to England, and with William of Orange in the 17th century, late 17th century. And of course, he ends up helping to found the Bank of England. So you have a huge, huge influence of these Italian city-states, which basically invent modern banking in the rise of the Atlantic maritime powers in the Renaissance.
Wow.
Oh. Yeah, that's a wow.
Well, it's just that, I guess what I get to is in my mind, I keep seeing the Knights Templars fleeing France and landing in Scotland just in time to save the Bruce and bringing the vast treasures with them. And so,
I just wrote a book called Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age, and I get into a bit more of this Venetian story in that book because, oddly enough, Venice knew, in my opinion, and I make the case for this in that book. I make a little bit of the case in Financial Vipers of Venice. I kind of clue people in that there's more of the story, and then I cover the story in Thrice Great Hermetica. What we're dealing with Venice is, in my opinion, Venice knew about the New World, possibly as early as the end of the Fourth Crusade. Now, oddly enough, who are their big European allies? Well, the allies, the traditional allies of Venice throughout the Middle Ages are the Templars. And I think Venice probably knew about the New World, kept it a state secret along with the Templars. That was a hidden source of bullion to them, and therefore they were able to use that source of hidden source of bullion to manipulate the bullion markets in Europe drastically at times. I cover a famous case of that in the 14th century of Venice literally destroying Florentine competitors by manipulation of the bullion ratios. So yeah. You have that going on. Then you've got an interesting text from the 16th century that was published in Venice claiming that two Venetians had actually sailed to the New World with Prince Henry Sinclair in the 14th century, long before Columbus. So I tend to think that there's something to that story. It has a lot of problems. I get into it in that book. But yeah, Venice knows all about these things. Their rivals, Genoa. Genoa, interestingly enough, is allied with the other great military crusading order in the Middle Ages, being the Knights Hospitaller. So in other words, you have these two great maritime banking powers. They are allied to the international military industrial complex of the age in the form of the Templars and the Hospitallers. And because of this, these two city-states in particular probably had centuries before the public announcement, probably had some knowledge of the New World and were privately and secretly exploiting it.
Okay. So we've got from the ancient to the money system. So where do we go to about the 1800s? So what's going on now with the money system and the pending collapse? Is it going to collapse?
I am not one of those who is beating the collapse drum, and I'll tell you why.
Okay. Tell us why.
Reserve currency status of a particular currency always accrues to the predominant maritime power of the age. This is true in Venice's case. It's later true of Portugal, then Spain, then France, then the Dutch for a very short period, and then finally the English. So long as a power is able to maintain its maritime power, its reserve currency status is assured. And by far, in a way, the United States Navy is by far and away, it outnumbers all the next 10 largest navies put together. So from that standpoint, the reserve currency status of the dollar is not under assault. But there's another much more significant reason. If we go back to the idea of an international medium of exchange, when you look at the international media of exchange during the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, they're of two forms. One is bullion, gold and silver. The other are international bills of exchange. Bills of exchange are traded internationally in the late Middle Ages, for that matter. So in other words, international commerce was going on. What they needed at the time to do this were banks and commodities brokers that could do the clearing on such things, the underwriting. And this is why you see the rise of insurance at this particular period in history too. Very, very significant development. So you have in international clearing today a unique thing. Most international clearing right now in the world goes through one of two hubs. It goes through the Society of Worldwide Interbank Financial Transfer in Brussels, it's otherwise known as SWIFT. And then there's the CHIPS system that's based in this country. These are the two main mechanisms of international financial clearing. And what is clearing? Most trade, like it or not, whether we want to talk about, you know, good old-fashioned gold bullion, the gold standard, all of this stuff, to me, that's just being a bit old-fashioned, because international clearing right now is electronic. And it happens in milliseconds. So in other words, reserve currency status will accrue to that power which has and is able to maintain the largest amount of space assets that make that clearing possible and is able to defend those assets. So in other words, again, the United States by far and away has the most space assets. There's every indication that we are able to defend those assets. So in other words, I'm not predicting collapse anytime soon. We've been hearing this collapse business since Nixon took us off of Bretton Woods, and it's kind of like predicting the rapture. They set all these dates and they keep moving them back. And it's not going to happen until you see, and it's beginning to happen in a certain small way, until you see nations of the world band together to create parallel systems of international clearing in their own hands, independent of the West system, with the space assets to handle that clearing and with the military assets to defend it. So we're a long way from that, in my opinion.
Well, that makes sense if you think in terms of the Nazis, but the Nazis just came here and they're still in charge. So can you tell us about the Nazi factor in our human history? Where did it really start happening? Who are the Nazis? Are they Anunnaki? No, you won't go there, but who are the Nazis? Are they the royals? Are they German? And
well,
are they in the United States and thus the world?
Okay, again, a very complex question, and I lay this whole thing out in several books. The best one for this particular subject, there's actually three. One is called the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. The other one is called the Nazi International. The third one is a book called Roswell and the Reich. I call that the book that ufology loves to ignore. what you have with the Nazis, first of all, is a cult. It's very important for people to understand that Nazism is not simply a political philosophy or a political party. It's a religion. It's a cult. And like all fanatical cults, it doesn't just go quietly into the night at the end of World War II. And let me give you an example of why I say that rather emphatically. If you look at the surrender instruments that the Germans signed in Reims, France on May 7th of 1945, and then again there was a repeat of the surrender in Berlin the next day, if you look at who is signing the surrender, it's very interesting. In Reims, it's Generaloberst, Colonel General Alfred Jodl, who is the chief of staff for the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht. He's, in other words, kind of the guy beneath Hitler in charge of it all. If you look at who's signing in Berlin on the next day, you have Field Marshal Keitel representing the German army. You have Admiral von Friedeburg representing the German Navy, and Colonel General Stumpf representing the Luftwaffe. You do not see on either of those two documents anyone signing in any official capacity for the surrender of the Reich government. Nor do you have anyone signing the surrender and abolition of the Nazi Party, which I think is one of the most glaring omissions in international law that you can think of. So in other words, what's surrendering is the German military, the Wehrmacht, all right? Now, if you step forward a bit into history, two things are happening at the end of the war that are very, very interesting. One is you have a number of German officers, general officers, contacting American intelligence. The most famous example being the case of Major General Reinhard Gehlen. Now, please understand, a major general in the German army is the equivalent of a brigadier general in the American army, all right? General Gehlen contacts an American general by the name of Siebert, who is in charge and related to American military intelligence, and he is negotiating with Siebert and Alan Dulles and all these people in American intelligence toward the end of the war to keep his entire military intelligence organization, an organization that was called Fremde Heer Ost, intact. Now, this is the entire German military intelligence organization on the Eastern Front throughout the war. It's a huge organization. He successfully negotiates with American intelligence, and I put the terms of this bargain that, believe it or not, we actually agreed to in my books. What happened was this entire organization was allowed to continue after the war, with General Gehlen himself still in charge of it, reporting to American intelligence and getting American funds to fund it that are not part of the occupation costs of post-war Germany. So in other words, on just this one score, by the time that President Truman signs the National Security Act of 1947 into law, which creates the CIA and the NSA. For all intents and purposes, the entire human on-the-ground intelligence source for the CIA's intelligence and analysis of Soviet capabilities and Soviet military intentions is being drafted by this post-war continuing Nazi intelligence organization under General Gehlen. It's so bad, Janet, that some of his reports were simply typed up on CIA stationery without further comment or analysis and presented to President Truman. So, in other words, you have a Nazi general briefing President Truman on Soviet mm-hmm. intentions. Now, that's just one part of the story. The other part of the story is that you had, of course, Operation Paperclip and bringing to this country hundreds of Nazi scientists, jet aircraft engineers, rocket scientists, medical doctors that created all of those hideous experiments in the camps. These doctors, the most famous being Hubertus Strugholt, all of these things are...
What was the rationale for bringing them here? Was there ever any...
The rationale was fear of communism.
Okay.
And the final thing, that's the second set. So in other words, you have the survival of Nazi intelligence intact as an organization, not just a bunch of Nazis in Eastern Europe hiding out from the Soviets, but an actual intelligence organization. That intelligence organization was rolled over to West German intelligence and became the basis for the Bundesnachrichtendienst, of which is modern Germany's intelligence. So in other words, the connection to this Nazi wartime intelligence organization is direct. Then you have the scientists. And then there's a third thing, and this is very important for people to understand. And I know this is going to sound totally wild, totally out there, totally crazy, but it's true.
Go for it.
You had, in addition to this, an international, what I call the creation of an extraterritorial post-war Nazi state. All right. In other words, mm-hmm. what they did was they realized that they did not need to be based in any particular country in order to function. They became, in effect, an underground country without borders. And what they did was they had enormous amounts of funding. And this is an aspect of the story that's so complex we could be all night talking about it. But they had enormous
right.
amounts of funding. And they continued, in my opinion, they continued some of their secret wartime research projects in other host countries, Argentina being the principal country, but many others. They set up, after the war, an international terrorist organization with deep roots to the radical Islamicist terrorist organizations we know today. There were connections between, for example, Yasser Arafat and the PLO and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, al-Husseini, and the Waffen SS and SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny. In other words, this was a huge post-war extraterritorial Nazi underground that was involved in everything from assassination to terrorism to arms smuggling. You name it, they were involved with it. They had tentacles reaching into the South American drug cartels. On and on this goes. So when you ask the question, are the Nazis in control today? My answer would be no, but they are certainly very influential. You cannot understand modern contemporary world events without understanding that this organization did exist after World War II, and it still exists today.
Right. Then we handed over our space program to Wernher von Braun, and I know that they kept bringing people in. They would take them to South America, to, where did you say?
Argentina.
Yeah, because I was working with a woman who had come the second wave. Like they continued to import people into the United States through Argentina. So she and her family came when she was a little girl. And
right.
so they just continued. They probably still are bringing them in. Her father was a Nazi. So you don't think they're in charge of here? So what level of influence do they have in the world at large? Or, you know, it seems like there's the Illuminati, right? We talked about the Illuminati, and there's somebody that really is in charge, and then there's all the puppets, which are like the presidents and the. I don't know if Queen is the puppet or she's the end of the line there. So
I don't.
About all that.
My personal view is that you have in the West today, in the structure of the West. I'm not a person that believes that there's one group orchestrating it all, okay? But let's assume there were. Let's assume there was such a group orchestrating all of these events with ineluctable omnicompetence and precision. What I think we see happening now is, as they're getting closer to their goal, the factional infighting is increasing. This is what I think you're seeing with the death of all of these bankers, with the strange diplomatic noises coming out of Europe, particularly from Germany, but also from other countries, Italy, France, and so on. I think what you're seeing is that as they near the goal, human nature is manifesting itself. Everybody's fighting for who's going to be in charge. Now, having said that I don't think the Nazis are in control, that doesn't mean that I don't think they're highly, highly influential. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Recently, we saw the United States install what, for all intents and purposes, is a neo-fascist regime in Kiev. There's just no arguing about this. And needless to say, the Russians are very upset about that. They had to fight Nazism and fascism in World War II. So in a certain sense, I don't blame them for being upset. But what's very interesting is that one of President Putin's major advisors, economic advisor, a man by the name of Sergei Glazyev, all right? Glazyev came right out recently in the last 4 to 5 months, I'd say, and stated that Russia's problem wasn't that it had to fight the Nazis in Kiev, and those were his words, but the Nazis in Washington, D.C., and I think what he was saying, what he was trying to get people to look at, was all those dirty deals with the Nazi devil that this country made at the end of World War II. It is highly influential. It was very influential in our space program. It was, and I suspect remains, very influential in our military-industrial complex. And it was and remains very influential hidden in the background, pardon me, of post-war Europe, and in particular of post-war Germany. So it is an influential organization. Whether or not it's ultimately going to be successful, I don't know. But when you stop and look at all of the Nazi connections to the Muslim Brotherhood, to the PLO, and all of this stuff, I throw the question right back and say, how influential was it? Well, it's very influential if it was able to create and sustain those types of terrorist organizations.
Okay. There was a question that was asking about the South American Nazi connection to the Pope. Oh, here it is. Oh, no, that's not it. Okay. I can't see the question, but what's the connection with our Pope that comes from?
Well, I don't know that there is one. I haven't found any direct connection to the current Pope. He used to be, as everyone knows, he used to be the Cardinal Archbishop of Buenos Aires, and there has been a certain amount of internet articles written about Pope Francis suggesting that he was highly connected to one of the last Argentine juntas. I don't know if this is true or not. What I do find suspicious is that the previous Pope, Benedict XVI, was, of course, Cardinal Ratzinger. He was German. He was the first German Pope in about 600 years. And then, of course, Ratzinger resigned, which is another first in several hundred years, to be replaced by a Pope from Argentina. And it does raise questions as to exactly what's going on. I strongly suspect that the real connection here, the real story behind these two popes, is that they both had intended, and certainly the current Pope looks like he's fully intent to clean house in the Vatican, and in particular in the Vatican Bank. I suspect that this is a large part of what's going on, and of course, the moment we say the Vatican Bank, then yes, we're dealing with all sorts of financial wheeling and dealing that goes all the way back to the loss of the Papal States in the 19th century. So what's going on there is anybody's guess. And I'd just say look at the Vatican Bank if you want to find connecting dots more than the Nazis.
Okay. Do you have a question, Sash?
It's a question. A lot of my listeners really wanted were taken by the explanation of the swastika as being showing how their bellcraft actually worked. And I loved your explanation of it. Could you explain that for our listeners?
Yeah. If you look at what the swastika is, if you look at the swastika, you know, the corporate logo of the Nazi Party, so to speak. If you look at what it is from the standpoint or from the viewpoint of a physicist, put on your physicist spectacles for a moment and look at it. What you have with the swastika is a vector diagram. And what I mean by that is the outer arms of the swastika would be a subsystem of rotation. In other words, you draw arrows on each arm of the swastika, and all the arrows are rotating in the same direction. The inner arms of the swastika would be a subsystem of stress. So in other words, you're going to draw arrows all pointing toward the center of the swastika, and each of those vectors being equidistant, in other words, the same magnitude of force, what you're describing, in other words, with the swastika, when you consider both subsystems together, is you're describing a system of rotational stress, all right? Now, what that means in terms of the bell is precisely because I think in the way I've attempted to hypothesize the physics behind the bell, I think what they were trying to do was create a stress in the physical medium itself via rotation, via a phenomenon that physics call torsion. And if you want to know what torsion does to the fabric of space-time, just imagine emptying a soda pop can and then wringing it in your hands like a dish rag. What will happen to the can is that the spiraling motion folds and pleats it. So in other words, what they're trying to do is create a little space warp, if you will, a stress in the medium, a rotational stress in the medium. And the swastika is kind of the perfect schematized logo for what they're up to.
Well, the swastika is ancient. It goes back to Persian, Sumer, and stuff.
Right.
Well, the Vipanas are the same thing.
Yeah, the
right.
Swastika is an old symbol.
Yeah, it is an old symbol, and it is, in my opinion, it is a symbol of a physics. It's a symbol of a science. If you look and do rotations of the constellation Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, around a central pole, you'll end up with a swastika. So in other words, it's a logo of a physics. So
okay.
It's an ancient symbol. It's part of that mythological lore that I think was created by that very high society in high antiquity to pass down to people a basic concept that would allow them to call their way back up to a similar pitch of development eventually.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left in the show. I know that you have some positive scenarios or outlooks that you can give us to end this on a high note. What would you like to talk about? It seems all this doom and gloom and Planet X is going to come in and wipe us out and yada, yada, yada. And we're going to have financial collapse. And is this all part of some kind of propaganda to keep us into, we call it fear porn?
Yeah.
Or is there so we can turn this around so we can have good life?
Again, I'm not a subscriber to the Planet X Nibiru hypothesis because, again, like I say, if that were true, it would leave a physics signature in the orbit of planets that we do not see. So in other words, I've never been on that bandwagon. And then the same thing with the collapse of the dollar scheme. I'm not saying that we won't go through economic hard times, but I think what we're seeing is we're transitioning. And I put it this way on many shows, and I'll say it again here. Humanity seems to go through these big cycles of major cultural change and shift, at least in the West, about once every 500 years. And we're in one of those cycles now. The last one we went through, of course, was the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Catholic Counter-Reformation about 500 years ago. And we're in another one now. The difference is that this shift is unlike, qualitatively and quantitatively, unlike anything that we have seen at any previous point in all of known recorded human history. And the reason why is we are seeing just a blizzard of new technologies coming online. They're slowly, in my opinion, slowly being leaked out, preparing people for all of these changes. Some of these technologies have to do with cheaper energy supply, cheaper energy sources. Some of them, like 3D printing and so on, will utterly transform manufacturing, particularly in the developed nations. We are seeing development and talk now of physicists able to teleport things in very small, minute quantities. So imagine, scale all of this up. Imagine you've got teleportation. You step into a phone booth in Chicago and you step out in Shanghai,
Right. Yeah, there goes all the airplanes.
There goes all the airplanes. There go the trucks. There go the railroads. It will totally transform human society. So
they charge you $5,000 to get into the teleportation.
Yeah, they might charge you $5,000. But, what I'm getting at here, folks, is that we are in an era of transition. So my advice is don't be too ready to believe the fear porn, as you called it. I like that term. And at the same time, we have to be individually responsible for owning and transmitting the best features of Western civilization and culture to our friends, our family, and so on. In other words, and I mean this quite literally, I mean that people have to be responsible enough to know Plato, to know Monteverdi, to know the Beatles, to know Bach, to know Victor Hugo, and so on, and to transmit
right.
it, because the system itself isn't going to do it for you. The system wants to collectivize you. And yet we have a technology now, just like we're talking here on this radio show. We have the technology to talk to each other, to be individual persons in a way that we never had before in history. So my advice is to people is, be discreet, be cautious, be prepared. Don't have this pie in the eye sky view of the future, but by the same token, don't think it's all going to be apocalyptic either. And take responsibility for yourself. Take responsibility for your role in preserving and passing on the best of what we've achieved thus far in human culture. And I think if we all do that, and learn to say no, when we have to. If we all do that, things won't be as bad as many people are predicting. At least I hope they won't.
Well, what about the we're running out of time here, and I wanted to touch briefly on the junk DNA that it was all turned off. They
uh-huh.
our life expectancy, but there are reports coming out that longevity. It was just like the last couple of days. They're going to able to reverse the aging crisis. I have friends, Dr. Arbus de Grey,
right.
And they have an organization, Methuselah the Project, that they're working on physical immortality. We have the decoding of the human genome. And I think the Citizen Information correlates with that the Anunnaki shortened our life expectancy so that we couldn't overwhelm them. It's much like the Planet of the Apes. If we have all these apes and there weren't that many Anunnaki, about 1,000, and there were millions of humans, they had to take a control, and part of it is by genetic manipulation. So what do you think of all that?
Well, I do think I wrote about life prolongation way back in my first book, and this is why I'm begging people to start taking some moral and spiritual responsibility as individuals for preserving all that is best about our Western culture and civilization. And there are many good things about it, just as there are many bad things about it. And if we look at life prolongation, it too is going to have an immense cultural effect. Because if we can imagine for a moment people living hundreds or perhaps thousands of years long, we currently have an educational system where we have to recycle the whole of human knowledge to a new generation about once every 20 years. And we have a short life cycle so that our most brilliant scientists are known for at best one or two major discoveries in a very narrow field. But now imagine a society in which all of us had the time to learn all of the disciplines and to learn them well, to learn biology, to learn genetics, to learn physics, to learn chemistry, to learn history, to learn literature, to learn music. And learn them well, and then pass that down. That will be a completely transforming cultural impulse, such as we've never seen before. By the same token, if you can imagine an Adolf Hitler or a Joseph Stalin having not one lifetime, but hundreds of years to perfect themselves in evil, or if you can imagine an Albert Schweitzer or a Mother Teresa having hundreds of years to do good, then you see the challenges we face. And this is why I think it is crucial for us to quit leaving it up to the educational system, to the professors and teachers. We all now, all of us right now, at this moment, have become responsible for knowing the best of our Western culture and knowing it in the detail that we are capable of knowing it, and to hand it down. And to to make the critiques of that culture that need to be made in a detailed fashion, and to hand that down. So, you know, the game is afoot. There's no more time to relax.
Right. So that's brilliant, and I agree, and I wish we had more time. We could talk about this whole show on this. We have 1 minute left. I want to make sure you tell our listeners how they can get a hold of your books and et cetera, your website. Where do they go?
They can get all of my books on my website web store at www.GizaDeathStar.com.
Wonderful. Thank you. Any kind of words to anybody that, to go off any second now? Want to say something?
This is our opportunity to change apocalypse to apocalypso and dance with the challenges we're confronted with.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming on your show. Love and blessings to everybody. Aloha.
Bye-bye.
I'd like to see you.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Who owns you? If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern in Studio A. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. There is blood on the wire. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern for Voices on the Wind with me, Ivy West. There are lives in the balance, people on the fire, children at the cannons. There are... Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.